Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's Saja webcast, your chance to interact with fascinating speakers from across the country and around the world. Please stay tuned for our next session.
Hi everyone, welcome to another webcast from SAJA, the South Asian Journalists Association. My name is Sri Srinivasan, and I'm co-founder of SAJA and Chief Digital Officer at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. We're doing our webcast today from the Met, where I'm calling in, and our guest is calling in all the way from Singapore. Today we're going to be talking with journalist Nisid Hajjari, at Nisid Hajjari on Twitter, at N-I-S-I-D-H-A-J-A-R-I on Twitter, who is the author of Midnight Furies, The Deadly Legacy of India's Partition, the most important book about the partition of India and Pakistan. Hajjari is a longtime SAJA member and a former editor of Newsweek, and he's joining us on the end of his tour that he's been doing in the U.S. and India and elsewhere about this book. We're talking in August, which is the anniversary month of the creation of Pakistan and the independence of India from Britain. So let me read you a little bit from the book's Amazon description, but let me also say hi to Nisid. Hi, Nisid.
Hi, Sri. Good to be here.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. Let me just read a little bit here that gives you a sense of the book. Says a few bloody months in South Asia during the summer of 1947 explain the world that troubles us today. Nobody expected the liberation of India and the birth of Pakistan to be so bloody. It was supposed to be an answer to the dreams of Muslims and Hindus who had been ruled by the Brits for centuries. But in August 1946, exactly a year before independence, Calcutta erupted in street gang fighting, a cycle of riots targeting Hindus, Muslims, then Sikhs, spiraled out of control. As the summer of 1947 approached, all three groups were heavily armed and on edge, and the British rushed to leave. Hell let loose. Trains carried Muslims west and Hindus east to their slaughter. Some of the most brutal and widespread ethnic cleansing in modern history erupted on both sides of the new border, searing a divide between India and Pakistan that remains a root cause of many evils. From jihadi terrorism to nuclear proliferation, the searing tale told in Midnight Furies explains all too many of the headlines we read today. And here are just some of the great reviews that this has gotten, including an Amazon Best Book of the Year so far, in the New York Times, a fast-moving and highly readable account of the violence that accompanied partition. In its finest moments, Midnight Furies is a story of what happens when a composite society comes apart. And our friend Fareed Zakaria from CNN writes, Hajjari explores the roots of this tension in a beautifully written, deeply intelligent book about that crucial moment when Britain once again drew bad borders with calamitous consequences. And maybe that's a good moment to and a good place to start this conversation. Nisid, it'd be fair to say that Fareed was talking about the Middle East when he said they once again drew bad borders. And your book makes the case that we can understand a lot about what's happening in the world today from those bad borders that were drawn in India and in Pakistan.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. This is a conflict, a tragedy that a lot of Americans in particular don't know that much about and don't understand how it affects their own history. But if you look at what the greatest security threats are in the world, ISIS obviously gets a lot of attention. But if you think about where the likeliest place of a nuclear war breaking out or of a nuclear weapon possibly falling into the hands of a terrorist group, it's in South Asia. And the reason that is because of the tensions that are there, because of this sort of Cold War between India and Pakistan that has lasted nearly 70 years, because of this fear, the strategic anxiety that Pakistan has about India as its potential existential threat. And that fear, the roots of that fear, begin with the partition. They don't end there. Obviously, you know, many things happen in the ensuing decades to deepen that that fear. But the basic posture was set, you know, within weeks of these countries becoming independent.
And when we look at how much people pay attention to the Middle East and don't pay attention to South Asia, I think that understanding the story of partition is so important. And there has, you know, the book that you've written is so important. And at the same time, even though people need to understand partition, I don't think there have been that many recent books on the topic. There's been obviously books like Raj Mohan's book about India after partition. Ramachandra Guha's book, India After Partition. But a lot of people pick up the story after partition, but you really set the stage very well.
Yeah, I look, the book concentrates on a very tight period, just August of 1946 to September of 1948. This is, you know, a year before and a year after independence. And most books, you know, when you talk about partition books, they're really books about the Indian freedom movement, and partition is sort of, you know, the last couple chapters of this, you know, long and generally positive, optimistic story. Or, as you say, they're books about modern India after 1947. The question I had was not exactly, you know, why it came to be that this united India was split by the British, but why the two countries that emerged from that partition would end up being such inveterate enemies. You know, is, you know, a year before independence, it was still possible to imagine that there would be a compromise whereby the subcontinent would remain united. Yet a year after independence, you had a situation where the two countries were fixed into a posture of hostility towards each other that they haven't been able to break out of. And so the question that motivated me was, you know, what is it that happened in these 2 years? What were the decisions that were made on either side? What were the sort of animosities and anxieties and suspicions that the leaders held towards one another that created this posture of hostility? You know, and if you look at it that way, it's sort of remarkable how much took place in just the span of a few short months, and how you know, you can sort of see almost decision by decision the two countries growing further and further apart rather than, say, coming together to deal with this tragedy, which was something that you know, affected both of them and threatened the stability of both new governments, and you know, could possibly have been an area of cooperation rather than conflict.
Let's talk a little bit about the history of partitions in other places. Where have we seen this in history that could have given us hope that things could have gone a different way?
That's a good question, because the other partitions that took place around that time, you know, Israel, Palestine, the Koreas, Iraq, you know, have not turned out well at all. You know, this wasn't a partition, but Northern Ireland is the example that most people bring up of a sectarian divide that, you know, took a very, very long time, obviously, but eventually it was, you know, found a way to heal. So it would not have been an easy thing, that's for sure. You know, I'm not saying that a different leader on either side would have necessarily made all the difference. You know, there were a lot of passions at work and a lot of animosities had been built up over decades under the British. You know, these communities, Muslims and Hindus, particularly in northern India, had been growing apart for quite a while. But it is remarkable to see how up until, you know, the very last minute, you know, there wasn't, you know, there may have been tensions between the communities, but they weren't organized. They weren't, you know, sort of, you know, these communities at the moment of partition didn't suddenly wake up and pick up weapons and turn on their neighbors. You know, what happened was that there were organized killing squads from each community that would whip up mobs that would go around and either kill or drive out minorities. I think without that degree of organization, the level of violence would have been much less, and I think would have been much more easily controllable. And people, even if they had suspicions about one another, you know, could have coexisted in the way that they had for generations up until that point.
And since your book focuses on that tight period, why don't you set the scene for us? What was happening in August of 1946, and where, especially for a lot of our listeners who aren't very familiar with that time period, may have seen the movie Gandhi, for example, and know a little bit about it.
Mm-hmm.
But to talk us through what the scene was at the time and the leaders that are worth paying attention to.
Sure. So in August 46, you'd basically, World War II had been over for about a year at that point. And at the end of the war, the British had decided that they had made very clear that they were going to leave India. We're going to grant India independence. And the only question was whether they would grant it to a united India or whether they would grant the demand for an independent homeland for Muslims in the subcontinent, which is Pakistan. Pakistan, this demand was being driven by the leader of the Muslim League, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, and in his case, it really was almost single-handedly. He was by far the dominant figure in his movement. On the other side, you had more familiar characters: Mahatma Gandhi, Jawaharlal Nehru, Sardar Patel. These were the leaders of the Congress Party who were fighting to preserve India as a united whole. And in the spring of 1946, the British had just finished holding elections throughout India in an attempt to sort of judge democratically how much support each side had. And the Muslim League under Jinnah had won the Muslim vote in many provinces and has shown, in that way that there was support for the demand for Pakistan. But the British had managed to cobble together a sort of compromise, a very unwieldy compromise, whereby India would remain united. There would be a central government that would have a few powers dealing with defense and foreign affairs and things like the currency, but that the individual provinces would really have most of the powers. And then in the northeast and northwest, the parts of India that eventually became Pakistan, those provinces could, if they wanted, join together and form sort of sub-regional groups that would, sort of a Pakistan within India. And both sides agreed to this. But then at a press conference that summer, Nehru, when asked about it, he was feeling pressure from his own party, said something offhand about how, this was just an agreement they were signing now, but once the British were gone, they would do whatever they wanted, that it wasn't binding. And this both embarrassed Jinnah and also, fundamentally destroyed any trust he might have had in the Congress leaders and their willingness to commit to giving Muslims a certain degree of political rights within India. So he called. He also withdrew his support for this plan and said, that up until this point they had tried to fight for their cause within negotiating rooms, but that now they're going to take the fight to the streets. And he called what he called a direct action day, that whereby Muslims all around the country were supposed to gather and listen to speeches and issue the call for Pakistan and demonstrate their support by the numbers that they could call out into the streets. And all over India, this took place peacefully, but in Calcutta, this huge city, former capital of the Raj, the Muslim leader, who is the premier of Bengal province, which Calcutta was in, is suspected of having encouraged various criminal elements to do a bit of looting and rioting. And this quickly got out of control and led to about 4 days of riots in which something like 15,000 people are thought to have died. And it was the most terrible riot Hindu-Muslim riot that had taken place under the British in India, and it sort of set off a chain reaction. It was at that point that, you know, riots started to spread to other provinces, that relations between the two communities became worse and worse, that the leaders on both sides, Jinnah and Nehru, who already didn't like each other, you know, now really grew especially vitriolic towards one another. And you start down this slope towards what would happen a year later, which was the partition, and then these riots that spread out over weeks and months, in which anywhere from 200,000 to a million people were killed. But it begins in August of 46.
As you were trying to get your hands around this enormous story and picking this particular time period, how much did you think that you would be able to keep this within this smaller frame, rather than kind of having to expand as editors and others wanted to put more things in?
Oh, you know, it's interesting. I had the opposite problem. I actually had started out with a broader period, a sort of 10-year period, because the narrative I was looking at, I was very curious about the relationship between Jinnah and Nehru, because they had known each other for 30 years. Jinnah was older and had, at the beginning of his career, been sort of political allies with Nehru's father. So they were family friends. And this was true among most of the Indian politicians, that, you know, this was a very small elite in the country. They all knew each other. They sometimes intermarried, but they were certainly, you know, social and family friends. But at a certain point in 1937, after elections that where Jinnah was leading the League and Nehru was leading Congress, their relationship turned very hostile, and the way they described each other both publicly and privately became very nasty and very personal. You know, I was looking at why that, what changed then, and then sort of how that played out over the next 10 years to lead to partition, which was an interesting story, but it became too unwieldy, and would have been a much, much longer book. And so I tried to telescope that a bit in the first chapters of the book, and really concentrate on this, you know, key period. Because as I said, you know, no matter how bad the relationship was and how tense relations between Hindus and Muslims had grown between 1937 and 1946, the fact is that there was this compromise. You know, it was unwieldy, but it was accepted. And no one knows how long it would have lasted or what other pressures it might have created. But at least, you know, if it had held for a couple of years, you would hopefully not have had the you know, really terrible riots that you did in August of 47. You know, it might have given all sides a bit of a cooling off period in which to, you know, allow the passions that the politicians had whipped up to die down. And, you know, if that had taken the place, I think the world would have been better off.
And of course, when you read this kind of history, you always think of all the what ifs and how the world might be different today. I'd love to have you read a little bit from the book to give our listeners a sense of the prose. But before that, why don't we tell people a little bit about your own background and and what you knew about partition before you got into this. And you, of course, are not a scholar of this region, but you were foreign editor of Newsweek and then editor of Newsweek, and you were in that very important period after 9/11, helping explain the world, especially the Middle East and South Asia to some extent, to America. Tell us a little bit about your background and what you knew about this part of the world, and then we'll have you read a little bit from the book.
Sure. Exactly. You're right. My background is as a journalist, not a professional historian, you know, for whom I have immense respect. And you know what I'd known about this period, you know, obviously I'd studied it before in university and so on. But I had come at it the way most people had, which was as the culmination of this freedom struggle, as the moment when a colonial people overthrew a European empire, for the first time peacefully, setting off a chain reaction of decolonizations across the world, and this moment is very important, for that. But then after 9/11, I was working with Fareed at Newsweek International, leading our coverage of the war in Afghanistan. And it became very clear to us very early on that the Pakistanis were helping to rebuild the Taliban by giving them safe havens and some degree of support from some elements in the security establishment. And I kept being asked this question by Americans and by readers, why is it that Pakistan takes billions of dollars in aid from the United States and still supports, these terrorist groups? And, I would explain that this has to do with the fact that they see India as their real enemy and are trying to maintain a degree of influence in Afghanistan. And it seemed to me that there was the story had taken on a new relevance outside the subcontinent, outside of India. This is no longer just about the freedom movement, about the beginning of one country or the end of an empire. It was really about the beginning of a rivalry that now affected everybody in the world and was central to American concerns about terrorism and about this, the war in Afghanistan. And so I thought I could try and bring some of my journalistic skills or background to explaining the story to a different audience that wouldn't have necessarily read the various histories about it that have been produced over the last several decades.
What are some things that surprised you as you read it? Like, what are things you had heard or things that, that's the kind of people think they know but weren't true, or what thought you knew but weren't true?
Yeah, there are two big ones. One, I should have mentioned, because I get this question a lot about my background. I grew up in the U.S. My parents are from India, from Bombay, and moved to the U.S. in the 60s. So I've only lived there for a few months while I was researching the book. But other than that, I grew up in the U.S. But most accounts that you read generally come from either the British or the Indian side. And in both, the Congress leaders, Nehru and Gandhi, come off fairly well. Gandhi is usually treated as a saint. And it is true that their message, their philosophical message that they wanted to maintain in India where all communities could live together in peace, is an attractive one. But one thing that surprised me was the degree to which those leaders turned out to be bad politicians. That they were great on the principles that they're upholding, but they weren't very good at coming to sort of pragmatic compromises with the Muslim League and with Jinnah. And Jinnah was, a difficult character. Even his friends said he was extremely chilly. One of them said that you needed a fur coat to be friends with him. And he didn't leave behind these kind of extensive writings and letters and diaries that Gandhi and Nehru did. So he's hard to get to know as a historical figure. But he was a lawyer. He was arguing a case, and I think he would have settled at various points along in the process. And what surprised me was the degree to which I would agree that the Congress leaders were as much to blame as he was for not reaching those compromises. That it was in their power as the larger, more powerful party to avert this tragedy, and they failed to do so. And there were plenty of critics at the time of them, but over the years, a sort of halo has grown up around them, and you don't hear that criticism anymore. So that surprised me. And then the second thing was, I think I also had the impression that somehow the violence was spontaneous and undirected, and that it really did involve peasants just you know, killing one another with the, you know, rough implements that they had at hand. And because that was also how riots had taken place in the past in the subcontinent. But this is very different. This was ethnic cleansing led by organized groups. And it wasn't that Nehru or Jinnah themselves were ordering this to take place, but you know, politicians lower down the food chain, local leaders had built up these militias in the summer before independence for self-defense, they said. But you know, at the same time, they were going off and setting, you know, homes and businesses on fire from the other community, killing a few people here and there. You know, they weren't contributing to peace. And then when the initial riots broke out, they were sort of the accelerant poured on the flames. So it surprised me the degree to which the violence was organized and how that took a situation that might have been controlled and made it virtually uncontrollable. That was something that I don't think is that well explored, because it's very rare. You can't find, you know, death squad leaders who sort of openly come out and say, you know, this is what I was doing. You sort of have to look at army situation reports, intelligence reports, you know, sort of contemporary accounts of what was going on to get a sense of it.
All right. So you're listening to our conversation with Nisid Hajjari, who is at Nisid, NISIDHAJARI on Twitter. And Saja is, of course, Saja HQ, at Saja HQ on Twitter. If you have a question or comment, please join us. We are going to open up the lines to allow questions in a couple of minutes. But in the meantime, I'm going to ask Nisid to read a couple of pages from his book that can help us kind of understand the writing style of the book itself. So, Nisid, you'll do that, and I'll say to our audience, if you have a question for Nisid, please dial in to our number, 347-324-5991, 347-324-5991, and hit 1 on your dial pad, and I will come to you, and you can ask a question directly, or you can email me a question, sree@sree.net, sree@sree.net, or at Saja HQ, and we'll ask the question if you don't want to be on the air with Nisid. Nisid, as I said, is calling in from Singapore. It's very early in the morning for him, so he's doing pretty well for someone who is been roused out of in the early hours to help us out. Thanks, Nisid.
Sure, thank you. So I thought I'd read a little passage from the moment in August 1947 when the riots first spiraled out of control. That, you know, it's important to remember that there had been riots taking place all summer long, ever since the British had announced that partition would take place, which they did in early June. And in fact, the independence ceremonies had taken place on August 15th, which was a Friday, but they had not released the maps showing exactly where the new border would go until the Monday afterwards. And so this passage starts on that Monday. "Sounds like a loose rail there," murmured D.G. Harrington Hawes. On August 18th, the Briton was crammed into a train engine with the driver and a Hindu soldier as they crossed a canal bridge in the Ferozepore district. They had left the other cars of the Calcutta-Lahore mail behind at the previous station while they tried to discover why no signals were coming from the posts ahead. It turned out that someone had removed two joints from the rails on the bridge. A pickaxe lay nearby. In this part of Ferozepore, the countryside was mostly flat and open, but at intervals, great clumps of a coarse, reed-like grass grew as much as 10 feet high. Harrington Hawes saw three Sikhs dodging through the grass about 200 yards away. He fired his revolver once in their direction. Returning to the rest of the train, the men decided to reattach the passenger cars and proceed before the line was sabotaged further. Although they didn't realize it at the time, most of the Hindu and Sikh passengers had mysteriously disembarked. When the train reached the canal bridge again, the wooden ties were charred, the Sikhs had tried to set the bridge on fire, and an entire rail had been removed. The three men were able to reattach the rail, and the train hurtled forward. But a mile before the next station, the driver suddenly slammed on the brakes. And, sorry. Slammed on the brakes and shouted, "My God, the track's gone." Harrington Hawes remembered thinking, "Now we're for it." And with squealing brakes, escaping steam, and a roaring and a crashing, the heavy locomotive plunged off the track, dragging the tender and the first three coaches after it. At the spot where they had derailed, the grass grew high and close to the tracks. Harrington Hawes could see the outlines of a large body of Sikhs hiding there, and more rushing to join them. It was dusk. Knowing that the train carried a small escort, the fighters seemed content to wait for nightfall before attacking. Soon there were hundreds of them. From the reeds came a chilling, triumphant cry, "Wah Guruji Ki Fateh, victory to the Guru." Apologize for my pronunciation. A day earlier, All India Radio had broadcast the detail of Radcliffe's boundary award. In that morning's papers, maps showed Punjabis precisely how their province would be sliced up. The details of the border should not have come as a great surprise, other than the transfer of parts of the Gurdaspur and Ferozpur districts to India. But Sikhs now had to abandon any hope of a more generous allotment from the Boundary Commission or a last-minute intervention by the Viceroy. It was official. Jinnah's Pakistan had split their community in two. That year, the end of Ramadan and the holiest day in the Muslim calendar, Eid, fell on August 18th. For Muslims living in the eastern Punjab, that was also the day when, quote, "the whole countryside seemed to have gone up as if on a prearranged signal," as Harrington Hawes later wrote. Not just in Ferozpur, but in the districts of Hoshiarpur, Gurdaspur, and Jalandhar, all in the now Indian half of the Punjab, large, well-armed squads swept down on Muslim villages and swarmed into Muslim neighborhoods and cities to begin methodically massacring their inhabitants. The Sikhs were merciless and single-minded. Some cried Rawalpindi as they struck to invoke the march slaughter. This was revenge. Right, that last bit I should have mentioned. There had been riots in the Rawalpindi district and around there in March of 1947. There were anti-Sikh riots conducted by Muslim mobs. And from that moment on, that's when the Sikhs really started to organize their death squads for revenge, as they were very open about saying. And they were the ones, they weren't solely responsible, but seemed to have been the ones that sparked the initial riots in August.
Wow, just listening to you read it just gives you a sense of the tragedy and the scale of this tragedy, even though you were focused on such a specific, just a single day, and how things went kind of totally wrong from there onward. I know we have a caller with a question, so we're going to go and ask and get the caller's question, and then we're going to come back and talk to you some more. Just stand by, Nisid. Let's see here. 203 area code, you're on the air with Nisid Ajari on Saja's Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is... Hello? Can you hear me?
Hi. Yes.
This is John Laxmi. I was struck by a comment you made just a few minutes ago about the fact that neither Nehru or Gandhi were organizing any of this. This happened more or less spontaneously. They were not organizing the violence. And I also heard, I think, in your NPR interview also about how some of the violence were just totally senseless people inflicting not necessarily Hindu versus Muslims. And that leads to a question that you might be able to comment on, at least. A lot of people have been blaming Modi for, the current Prime Minister Modi, for what happened in Gojra in 2002. And I think from your description of your professional career, you probably were there at that time in India. And so things happened then spontaneously, senseless violence. And again, things seem to happen in Gujarat in 2002, the Gojra riots. Can you draw any parallels between the two?
That's a good question. I was not in India. I was working in New York for Newsweek during the 2000s. So I did not, investigate this particular incident. But what I can say is that what happened in 1947 should be a caution to all politicians in the subcontinent that it's, you are not guiltless just because you didn't order, squads to go out and kill, members of the opposite community. That if you allow a certain kind of rhetoric to take place, if you look away when underlings are organizing violence, if you encourage the kind of sectarian rhetoric that divides communities, for political gain, you're playing with fire. This is very difficult to control after it started, and it's early on that something can be done about it, not afterwards. And I think leaders have to be held responsible for the actions of their underlings. Nehru, there were riots in Bihar after those Calcutta riots that I mentioned. There were Hindus killing Muslims, and they killed about an estimated 7,000 Muslims. And Nehru flew there and flew around the province, tried to stop these riots almost single-handedly. Was very valiant about it. But what he ignored was the fact that the Congress government in that particular province had held rallies, against the League and against Jinnah. And again, they could say that they were just holding rallies to promote a united India. But of course, in the crowds, the message was taken that the Muslims were responsible for killing Hindus in Calcutta, and that there needed to be revenge. And that's how these other riots started. It's really just not something that politicians now or then should be playing with. It's far too dangerous.
Can I follow up with Leslie's question?
Go ahead.
Have you seen this movie called Bajrangi Bhaijaan? Now that's somewhat controversial. Some people have said it's totally unrealistic to imagine any kind of détente between the two countries. Do you have any comment on that?
Yeah, so I have to admit, I have not seen the movie. I've only read about it. So I can't speak to the movie specifically. But yes, whether there is a possibility of détente between the two countries, I do think there is. And in fact, I was on a panel in India recently with a leading journalist there, Shekhar Gupta, who made the point that there has been détente since 1999, which is the last time the two countries really fought one another in Kashmir. Yes, there are cross-border shelling, and there's obviously the terrible Mumbai attacks and so on. The two countries, since they show that they each have nuclear arsenals, I think have started to realize that an outright conflict between them is pretty much unthinkable. There's no way in which, let's say, a retaliatory Indian strike because of a terrorist attack, there's no way to guarantee that wouldn't escalate into a full-scale war and possibly a nuclear confrontation. And I think both sides sort of realize that that's the case and that it's not worth it. Now, what they need to do is move beyond the sort of cold peace to something warmer, and that's going to take a lot of effort. It's going to take opening up trade and borders to people-to-people exchanges and so on. And not enough attention is paid to that sort of thing. That hopefully that'll start to change.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Sorry about that sound. Thanks, John, for your call. And for people who didn't hear the title of that movie, it's called Bajrangi Bhaijaan. And I just did a Google search, Nisid, and it's playing in 3 theaters near me here in New York. So shows you how much the world has changed, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
And you can also, I'm sure, find it in Singapore. It's one of the biggest movies of all time in India, and has that element about India and Pakistan as you were discussing. So we have about 15 minutes left. Let me ask you about the books and the kind of history of research that you did for this. How did you get the time to do this? You got a book contract, and then you said you went to live in India. So talk about all of that. And the book that I had read about partition that I had recommended to lots of folks to kind of understand partition was a book called Freedom at Midnight, which is out of print, and was written by Dominique Lapierre and Larry Collins. And if yours is kind of has that journalistic take on history, theirs had a novelistic take on history. So maybe start there. Tell us about that book and what you thought of it after having read it after so many years. Does it still hold up in any way? Obviously, it's no longer in print, and your book is very different from that.
It certainly holds up in a novelistic way. It's an amazing read, and they did an incredible reporting job because they were, this was written in the early 70s, and a lot of the players involved in partition were still alive, and they interviewed hundreds and hundreds of them to build up this narrative. But the downside of it is that it's really more of a novel than a history. That a lot of their account is based on the memories of Lord Mountbatten, the last Viceroy of India, who was a notorious fabulist. You can see in Mountbatten's papers at Southampton University in the UK, you can read him describe the exact same situation in 1947, and then later in the 50s, then later in the 70s, and with each retelling, his role becomes more central, and there's some crisis, and Mountbatten comes and saves the day, and, if you cross-check that against other accounts of the same incident, you realize that some of it is just flat-out not true. There are myths that have grown up, this idea that he made up the date of August 15th, on the spur of the moment at a press conference, which wasn't true, various other things. So it's a great read, but its accuracy is definitely in question. It is the best known popular history of this period. There was another one more recently called Indian Summer by Alex von Tunzelman, that is a great book that concentrates on the suspected relationship between Nehru and Edwina Mountbatten, Lord Mountbatten's wife. But most of the other books are academic books, or they're only printed in the subcontinent, so not readily accessible to a wider audience. When I started on this one, I had just finished up a decade at Newsweek, and it was changing ownership, I had gotten this contract and decided that I wanted to work on the book full time. I left the magazine. My wife and I sold our apartment in Brooklyn, and we basically lived out of suitcases for the next 2 years while I worked on the book. We spent a few months in Delhi researching, and then we spent about a year in London. Because the British records were very extensive and very well organized. The same records you'd find in India, you would find in the UK, just a little better organized, and so you're able to get through more material faster there. It was just a process of going through the archives day after day after day. These old telegrams, some of them signed by Churchill and Nehru, and you go through these folders, you don't really know what you're going to find, and you're looking for not just what happened, but the kind of details and color and anecdotes that would bring the situation to life. And sometimes you would find that in the official papers. A lot of times you would have to go to sort of smaller archives and find the personal papers of, say, British generals who were in India at the time, American journalists who were passing through, people who were observers, weren't necessarily the main characters, because obviously the papers of the main characters had been pored over by researchers previously. So trying to find something new was hard. And then we came back to the U.S. where I spent about a year writing a draft of the book. And in fact, one of the most useful archives I found were the U.S. State Department archives down in Maryland, because very few people look at them. And the Americans weren't directly involved in partition, but, you know, at this time, 1947, it was very clear that they were the dominant post-war power. And all the parties, Nehru and Jinnah both, were very eager to have the Americans on their side. And so they would, you know, go to parties at the U.S. Embassy. They would debrief the American diplomats there. And the Americans, because they didn't really have a dog in the fight, actually, you know, wrote back to Washington very clear, very even-handed cables that you know, weren't biased by, you know, kind of the centuries of history that the British had, for instance. And so they were both interesting political insights and great anecdotes that you found there that you wouldn't have found elsewhere. You know, one of which, for instance, there's a great controversy over how Mountbatten sped up the departure of the British to August, leaving them only about 2.5 months to get ready. You know, a lot of people still suspect that this was done on purpose in order to weaken India and Pakistan. And in fact, the British Prime Minister told the American ambassador on the day this decision was made that they were only going to give power to India in August because India had a government and it was ready to take power, but that they would still control Pakistan for several more months, possibly another year, until its government got set up. You know, of course, nobody had asked the Pakistanis about this, and the plan fell apart very quickly. But it just shows how sort of poorly thought through some of these decisions were at the time.
What is your sense of how things could have been different? You know, we talked a little bit about the what ifs. What are things that could have changed the narrative? We read about kind of the health of Jinnah, for example. Is that something that you looked into, and how does that figure into the story?
Yeah, no, that's it's interesting. There's a story, and it comes from Freedom at Midnight, that supposedly Jinnah's doctor knew, you know, in early 47 that he had tuberculosis and was about to die, and that if Mountbatten had known this and had delayed, that this partition would never have happened. But I think it's been pretty conclusively proven that wasn't true, that, you know, Jinnah had been a sick man for a long time. You know, every year in the 40s, he would sort of disappear for a month to some hill station to recuperate. He was a 2-pack-a-day smoker, extremely thin. You know, he was elderly. I mean, you know, people knew he wasn't doing well, but there's no evidence that his tuberculosis was you know, life-threatening until the summer of 1948, when he went off to recuperate in Baluchistan and never really came back. So I don't think that a delay necessarily would have made a difference. I think, well, you know, what would have made a difference would have been, you know, first of all, if all sides would have committed to this compromise in 46, what was called the Cabinet Mission Plan, if Nehru had not made these public comments at his press conference that sort of blew up the deal. I think that could have changed things. If the leaders on both sides had listened to the governor of the Punjab, who's a British official, but who knew the Punjab very well, and he was the one saying, you know, for months ahead of partition, that all these groups were arming and they were being funded by the political parties, you know, within the Punjab, and what he wanted more troops, and he wanted the leaders in Delhi to send the word down to their underlings in the Punjab. To cut it out, to stop organizing these groups, to stop sponsoring arson attacks and so on. You know, if that could have been done before August of 47, I think the violence would not have been so bad. And then finally, if the leaders in Delhi had listened to the Sikhs, you know, after these riots in March of 47, the Sikh community was traumatized, and they really had sincere and legitimate fears about what would happen to them as a tiny minority within if they ended up in Pakistan, and the border that everyone was talking about would have run right through the middle of the Punjab and would have split their community in half. And the Sikhs were trying to argue that the border should have been drawn, you know, in a different way to try and include most of their community within India. And that was never going to happen. And it should have been made clear to them much earlier on that it was never going to happen, and that, you know, they needed to figure out what it was they were going to do, what they were going to tell their followers about this ahead of time. But it didn't happen partly because, you know, Jinnah didn't think it was his problem. He was fairly callous about this. And Nehru wanted to the Sikh threat was sort of useful to him because he was hoping that India would get more territory in the boundary award, because maybe the British would think this would be a way to prevent violence. So he also didn't, sort of sit down with the Sikh leaders and explain, what was going to happen. And I think both of them, Nehru and Jinnah, neither of them knew the Punjab that well, and I don't think they took the Sikh threats all that seriously. So if that had been different, I think the violence would not have been quite so widespread, and maybe then the troops that they had in place would have been sufficient to quell them early on.
So we have only a few minutes left, so we're going to make this the lightning round, and we're going to get several questions into you. One of them is kind of thinking about how hard it is today to deal with separating out people based on drawing things on a map. But in 1947, this is before Google Maps and other kind of technology tools, how did they manage to do what they did when, in fact, you're drawing things in the middle of villages and sitting in, you know, away from these places? How did they do that? And, if you've been to the Wagah border, I'm talking to the audience, anybody who can go either what's called the border of India and Pakistan in a town called, in the area called Wagah, W-A-G-A-H, you can go from India, and I presume, I've never been from Pakistan, but you can go from the Pakistan side. You can see that there's just a line in these fields, and that's Pakistan and this is India. It's a very upsetting place to stand and watch. I took one of my students, a group of students came with me, and we saw, I had a student from Mexico who was just standing there and just thinking about borders in America and Mexico as well. It was a very moving and sad kind of place.
No, it's a great question. The one thing is the British, were great cartographers, right? So they and they had, you know, the system of district officials. So they knew down to the village level, generally speaking, you know, who lived where, which communities. So the decision about where the line would go was supposed to be based on population. So districts that had a Hindu or a non-Muslim majority would go to India, and those that had a Muslim majority would go to Pakistan. And the fact was that was pretty clear because they had these census data, they had these maps. And in fact, a year before independence, more than a year before, the previous viceroy had his officials draw up a draft line to see what it would look like if you drew a line based on population. And that was the line that almost exactly became the final border a year later. It should not have been a huge surprise because everyone, you know, the populations were known. The various communities sat before this boundary commission and argued, they tried to put forward different figures or they made different arguments like, you know, okay, this district might be Muslim majority, but it has a very important Sikh shrine in it, so therefore it should go to India. There are various things like that, and there were some tweaks that were made, including one sort of last minute tweak after pressure from Nehru to sort of keep important canal headworks which fed various princely kingdoms in India to keep that on the Indian side. There are little tweaks like that, but what the real problem wasn't that it's artificially divided villages. It was that it split the Sikh community in half and left more than a million of them on the Pakistan side of the border. And that was that was the signal. That was the sort of what the Sikhs had said they would not tolerate. And the fact is that there was no physical way to draw the border in a way that would have been fair to both sides and would have met the Sikh demands. And Mamban himself admitted that and had no answer. He just said, that's up to you to figure out. You have to come to some sort of political compromise. But it wasn't the map maker's fault.
And of course, there's a whole other conversation to be had, and maybe in a future date, about the eastern side of India. Without the Sikhs, there was, the creation of what became East Pakistan and then eventually Bangladesh, that without the Sikh issue there, we saw tremendous violence and of course, yet another country being born from this many years later. So that's something we'll have to talk about another time. A word about Mountbatten, since you brought him up, and it's easy now, I guess, to look back and see the role that he played and then didn't play. Some of it is exaggerated, but he did meet the most kind of cruel end, and something that's hard to think about now, that you started this conversation by talking about kind of Northern Ireland and those changes, but to think that a relative of the Queen, first cousin, I believe, right, could be killed by the IRA, and today that relationship has been repaired, is kind of unfathomable to my mind. And my kids were watching a CNN documentary about that, about the 70s, and we concluded that maybe there's hope with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and ISIS and all of that, that maybe things can get better if that relationship could be repaired. Is that too rosy a Pollyannish thought?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, I think if speak to, ordinary Indians and Pakistanis, majorities are in favor of closer ties. I mean, majorities are also suspicious of each other's government and their intentions. But in terms of people-to-people ties, people are looking for more trade. They're looking for more exchanges. They want closer relations. And it makes sense. I mean, there are all sorts of strong economic reasons why these two countries should be more integrated. As I said, the nuclear weapons almost guarantee that there can't be another major conflict. So I think the chances of the relationship improving are good. The groundwork is there. But it's going to take strong leadership, and it's going to take leadership that is willing to ignore the kind of rabid nationalist media that we have here in the U.S. as well. It's not just India and Pakistan, but as somebody pointed out, India and Pakistan are at war every day on cable TV. But if you go to the border, if you go to ask ordinary people, that's not the case, and I think that's what political leaders have to keep in mind.
So that's a nice optimistic note on which we will end. The book is called Midnight Furies, The Deadly Legacy of India's Partition by Nisid Hajari, at Nisid, Hajari, on Twitter. And you've been listening to my conversation with him. Thank you for calling in all the way from Singapore. His book is available all over the world and on Amazon and other bookstores and in South Asia itself. And how has it been received there, Nisid?
Oh, it's been great. I just got back from a week in Delhi and Mumbai, and it was really heartening because, your fear obviously is that this is a story that people there have grown up with, and many of them, think they already know and wonder why there's another book about it. But lots of very, very smart people I respect greatly, were telling me that there were things in the book that they hadn't known and that had surprised them and that they found refreshing. So that was really great to hear. So.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And thank you for all your help and support of Saja all these years. You've spoken at multiple events. You've guided and helped lots of young kids who went into journalism, so we appreciate all of that. And please keep in touch, and good luck with the book and your work at Bloomberg.
Thank you so much, Ray. It was great to be here. Thank you.
You've been listening to a Saja webcast. You can catch all our activities at saja.org and sajaforum.org. Our email is saja@columbia.edu. We'll leave you with the musical stylings of Cooper Madison of CooperMadison.com.